Going Linux, episode 152, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
In today's episode, listener feedback.
Today's episode of Going Linux is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible is the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with over 75,000 titles. If you are a regular listener, you already know that we have a special URL that lets you get a free audiobook from Audible when you sign up for a 14-day free trial. Whether you are a regular listener or a new listener, if you haven't signed up, the place to go to get your free audiobook and 14-day free trial is www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. There is currently no Audible player that runs natively in Linux, so before you sign up, make sure that you can either run the player under Wine or that you have a portable device like an Android or other smartphone that can run the Audible player. audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux for your free audiobook and 14-day free trial. Well, Tom, how goes the replacement for your home phone? Is Google Voice, Google Chat working for you?
Google Voice, Google Chat all the way. I still have not dropped my Skype number. It's cheap. It's like $6 a month. So I renewed it for another 3 months. It was about to expire, and that made me nervous, but I haven't been using it at all.
Well, it's good that you've been able to run kind of a parallel test before,
right.
Before completely weaning yourself off the Skype fees. And of course, you could always keep the free Skype account, but you won't have the number,
right.
I guess.
I won't have the number. But if I haven't used it in 3 months, I'll drop it, let it go.
Okay. And we are using Google Voice to do this recording, so this will be our first test of Google Voice as our podcast recording medium, if you will.
Well, sort of. We got a. Once again, we're paralleling here. I'm using Audacity also.
Exactly. We're recording Audacity on both ends. We really only used Skype to communicate back and forth anyhow.
Right.
We weren't really recording the Skype channel.
Okay, listen. I'm looking at the top of my page here.
Uh-huh.
It says, your browser's current Zoom setting is not fully supported. Please reset to default Zoom.
Okay.
I wonder how you do that.
Control 0.
Really? All right.
Uh-huh.
Control 0. And nothing happened. Oh, yes, it did.
That's our tip of the month.
Well, that worked fine. Okay.
I didn't know that Chrome had some specifications on Zoom settings. It's kind of weird. It would let you go to an unsupported Zoom setting.
I don't know what that was. I've zoomed all over the place before, but on Google Docs, I don't know.
Okay. Maybe it's a Google Docs thing.
Yeah.
Good news is Google Voice is helping, and we're one more step towards fully Googleizing our lives.
Yeah.
If only they would come out with a Google operating system. Oh, wait, they have.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then a Google phone says, oh, wait, they mm-hmm. have. Google email, yeah, they have that. Google Ads,
Microsoft's getting it, too. Google
Search, yeah. Google Office Suite, yeah. Maybe we should go get a Chromebook.
There you go.
Google all the time.
Android.
I think not. Moving right along.
So let's get to our feedback, and who's up first?
Well, our first message is from John. It's a voicemail, and he has some information for us on the more command. He wrote us an email as well and then attached the voicemail. So his email reads, "Hi, Larry. Hi, Tom. Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Please find attached an Ag Vorbis file with a response to episode 148, Linux Antivirus Advanced. I hope the tips I offer in it may be useful to you and or your listeners. I hope the Ag Vorbis format is okay. I created it using Audacity on my iMac and haven't yet installed the library needed for exporting to MP3. Thanks again for your great podcast." And John, Ag Vorbis is
just fine.
Not a problem. In fact, it's the preferred file format for audio of the Going Linux podcast, if there is one.
If there is one, yeah. He can use whatever you want.
That's true. So let's listen to John's voicemail.
"Hi, Larry. Hi, Tom. This is John Watney from Minneapolis. I wanted to thank you for your great podcast. I like how, compared with many Linux podcasts, yours has a minimum of trash talking and advertising, and essentially no self-promotion. Like your goal with teaching people about Linux, your podcast is focused on getting things done, that is, providing your listeners with useful information. I recently listened to episode number 148, Linux Antivirus Advanced. I wanted to thank you especially for the tip on changing sloppiness to speed up your computer. I remember coming across this tip a while back, but lost the setting in my distro swapping from Ubuntu to OpenSUSE and then to Linux Mint. One tip I thought I would pass on would be more effective use of the more command. During your segment on installing Bitdefender, I was rather surprised that you kept hitting enter to scroll through the verbose licensing text one line at a time. 20-some years ago, when I was working and playing with BSD 4.3 in college, I learned to use the space bar rather than the enter key when using the more command to go through text one screen at a time. This behavior is carried through to the more commands in Linux, OS X, and even, surprisingly enough, DOS and then Windows command line. When viewing text using the more command in a modern distribution allowing a terminal window with many lines, or even when running through an SSH session in such a terminal window in Windows, OS X, and Linux, this can allow seeing as many lines as will fit in the window. So, making the window as tall as possible will really speed up going through long bits of text. Another advantage when using the spacebar to go through text a screen at a time, when using a text-based installer, is that should you accidentally hit that key too many times by the time you get a yes, no, or whatever prompt, you can delete the extra space characters, choose your desired response, and then hit enter. Recently, I've gotten around to using the less command rather than more when listing the contents of text files in a Linux command line prompt. A major advantage of less over more is that it uses the same editor commands as the VI editor. So you can, for example, page up as well as down, jump to the start, end, or specific line of a file, and search for a specific text in the file. I hope some of your listeners who are new to Linux and are trying out the command line may find this information helpful. Thanks again for your great podcast, and have a great day."
Well, John.
Wow, excellent advice.
Very good. And yeah, having listened to your message, I realized that my command line skills have gotten very rusty, having used the graphical user interface for so long. Yeah, I used to know that you could hit the space bar, and now I know it again. So, John, thanks.
Right. Why don't you... contact us again in about 5 years when we forget.
Yeah, hey, that'd be great.
And thanks for all the kind words. We appreciate it.
Yes.
Next up, we've got Mike's voicemail on running a live CD on public computers. Let's listen.
"Hi, Larry and Tom. This is Mike in Asia. I've been a listener to your show for about 3 months. Really appreciate everything you guys have shared and taught me. Since I've been listening, I've tried various distributions. I started on Puppy Linux and then moved over to Ubuntu and tried different desktops on that. And now I'm going for Mint and trying that out. So I think I'm going to stick with that. My main question today is a security one. I've heard in my travels that it's not good to log into your email account on public computers. So if you go into a web bar, or if you're at a university computer lab, it's not good to log into the to your email because your password and the content of your email account might be captured by the by some spyware that's on the computer. So I'm wondering if a solution to that might be to run a distribution of Linux from a live CD. The main question is, would the operating system on the public computer somehow be able to monitor your web activity or to give you viruses or to log your keystrokes in some way while you're using that distribution of Linux from the live CD? So that's my main concern. Another one is, would system administrators have a policy against booting live CDs on public computers? Because I imagine if the system administrator comes around and notices, oh, what's that operating system you're running on my computer? I'm just wondering if that might be a concern to them. So I'd be curious to see what your thoughts are about that. As I said, I'm Mike in Asia, and I'm with all the piracy that goes on in Asia with software and operating systems, I'm really keen to share information about Linux with my Asian friends and try to get them on the system because really appreciate that it's free and available and has lots of different languages that can be used. Okay, thanks a lot for your hard work, and be interested to hear your thoughts.
Okay, Mike, well, we know that he's in Asia and he's at a school
or a playground, or,
and there's a flagpole nearby,
or Chuck E. Cheese or something.
Yeah. And it's windy.
Yeah. And a lot of good questions there too.
Yeah.
Mike. So maybe we should get to answering them.
Well, first of all, in order to boot that live CD or thumb drive, the BIOS has to be set up to permit it. So you might have to go into the BIOS at the start of the boot and put the CD or the thumb drive in the boot path. It probably isn't right now.
Right, and that may be where the public computer owner might have a little heartburn.
Right.
Yeah.
And let's see what else. Could there be a keylogger that's hardware? I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. And that would be the risk of running any public computer that you don't have control of, is that someone, the owner or the proprietor of the public computer facility that you're in, may have put it there, or someone else who has used that public computer may have surreptitiously put it there and may be recording keystrokes and then may come along at some other time and
harvest.
Pull that device off. Yeah, and get your keystrokes, including passwords and logins and all those sorts of things. But I think in general, using a live CD on a public computer would be a good way to make sure that you don't end up getting infected when you're using a public computer, especially if you're using it to create documents or download something from the internet. If that machine is infected, whatever your file is that you're creating or downloading, there's a risk that it will become infected as well, of course. So you want to make sure that you are using an environment like a live CD to protect yourself from that kind of infection. But as Tom said, you're still at risk of someone finding your password or whatever. I mean, you could put a firewall on the live CD. So you could boot to the live CD and then install a firewall and then do your computing and your browsing and so on from there. And that will help protect you. But that's not going to help you if there's a hardware keylogger.
Right. If somebody took that keyboard apart and put some hardware in there to do the key logging, doesn't matter what you're running, it's going to record it.
Right. So my recommendation is that you bring your own laptop, if you have one, and connect wirelessly to a public access point, whether that's that facility where they have public computers or whether it's just a coffee shop or somewhere that has public access, Wi-Fi. And then if you have a second computer available to you, set that up at home and then VPN from your laptop into that home computer using a VPN like Hamachi or something like that. And then you're assured of a secure connection. And in fact, your browsing is being done from your home computer. It's just going to this laptop on a public access point. Of course, that requires that you have a laptop or netbook and that you have a second computer at home, and that's not something everybody can afford. So using a CD, a live CD on a public computer and using available security software, that's probably not a bad second choice.
Right. And one more thing, and I do this all the time. You've got two fields to fill in. One is your username and one is your password. Well, if there is a keylogger of some kind, it's not logging your mouse. So go to your username and type a couple letters, and then use your mouse to jump to the password field and type a couple letters of your password, and then jump back up to your username. And if all that's being recorded are the keystrokes on the keyboard, well, now they're scrambled.
Right. And another way to accomplish a similar sort of thing, Tom, would be bring a thumb drive with your username and password on a text file on the thumb drive, and then open the file and copy and paste it.
Oh, yeah. Good idea.
It's not going to record the keystrokes because there aren't any. You're just using the mouse to do copy and paste, or Control-C, Control-V, or something like that.
Sure.
So that would work too. So, Mike, good luck. Let us know how things work for you. Moving along, we have Danny, who asked about Mumble. And Danny wrote, "Hello, Larry and Tom."
Hello, Danny.
Hello, Danny. "There are some podcasts and chat rooms that use Mumble. I understand why Mumble is used. It's a cross-platform software open to use by any user of any operating system. But the program is not accessible for people using a screen reading program. Some say it is workable once a sighted person sets it up, but many have no one to come by to do that. Might there be a way to write the developers of Mumble about this problem?" Well, Danny, yes. I did a little bit of research, and the Wikipedia page for Mumble, and Mumble, maybe we should define that. Mumble is software that allows you to do voice over internet and allows you to do recordings, and we could use it instead of Google Voice or Skype.
And we tried it.
We tried it, and it works just fine. So the Wikipedia page lists Torvald Natvig as the original author of Mumble. And we'll include some links in the show notes to the Wikipedia page where that's listed and to the mumble.sourceforge.net webpage for contributing. And I wasn't really able to find a place where you could submit a bug or anything like that, but contributing might be the place to go, their contributing link, or onto their IRC chat or something like that. But we'll provide you a couple of links there. And quite frankly, in our experience, Danny, in setting up Mumble, even a sighted person has problems.
Yeah, it's no fun at all. It's not intuitive.
And I'm sure that even if it were accessible, it would still be difficult to set up.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why we're not using it. I mean, once it is set up, it works just fine, but it's a bit of a disaster in terms of configuring it in the first place.
Yeah, I tried and failed.
Yeah.
We got it to work, but not well.
Right. So we'll continue on with what we're doing. But thanks to the guys over at Linux Basics for offering us the opportunity to use their Mumble server.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And next up we have Scott. Scott says, "Hi, Tom and Larry." Hi, Scott.
Hi, Scott.
"I installed Ubuntu 10.04 on a Pentium 4 CPU with a 3 GHz dual processor. The motherboard is an Asus P4S800D. The problem was that the mouse and keyboard locked up after Ubuntu booted into the desktop. had the same problem with Ubuntu 10.04 and 11 Live CD and Linux Mint KDE Live CD. Worked with Linux Mint 10 XFCE. That's odd. After researching this problem, found that the fix is to disable ACPI/APIC support in BIOS, which disables one of the dual-core processors, and he gives us a link. After doing this, the keyboard and the mouse don't lock up anymore. When I go to System Monitor, it only shows one processor instead of two. Is there any other way to fix this problem so both processors will work? Love your show. It's the best Linux podcast. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Scott. Well, thank you, Scott. So he's down to one processor, huh?
Yeah, it appears that this fixed one thing and broke something else. So I did a little investigation into that forum thread and found in post number 39, for those of you following along at home, that someone named J.F. Sebastian used some settings that appear to have enabled multiple cores or re-enabled multiple cores on his computer. And I asked Scott if he had tried those settings before switching off APIC in the BIOS, and he responded, found a YouTube video that told me how to edit grub. I added those commands into the BIOS, and when the computer rebooted, I had the same problem of mouse and keyboard locking up. I checked grub.cfg, the file, and confirmed that the line of code was there. And he provides us a link to that YouTube video for those of you wondering how to edit the grub. So at this point, I'm at a bit of a loss. I don't know how we can help you out, Scott, other than continuing to do some research. So I think at this point, our best bet is to, if there's somebody out there with this particular model of Asus computer, this P4S800D, who has this problem, if you've got it fixed, let us know and we'll pass the information on to Scott.
Or Scott can just use Linux Mint 10 XFCE and settle for that and have two processors running.
There you go. Or he could continue to use it and with one processor.
Yeah.
But I don't think he wants either of those from the sounds of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be nice if it just worked.
Yeah, that's a sticky one.
Another solution would be to retire that Asus and go get another computer.
Right, right.
probably the more expensive solution of the bunch, so probably not something he wants to do. All kidding aside, let's go on to Danny's email.
Okay. Danny says, hello, Larry and Tom. Hello, Danny.
Hello, Danny.
My uncle has a W machine that is in need of being reformatted. It's filled with pop-ups and also Windows pop-up asking what dial-up service he needs. My uncle uses broadband, so that should not be happening. Being up in years and not very knowledgeable about computers, he needs something that just works. So, until his machine is fixed, I may give my uncle a DVD or a CD of either Ubuntu or Linux. The reason I mention Linux is because of my need to use Orca. He would not need that accessibility program at all. What distribution might work for a senior who just wants his machine to work? Danny.
I don't think there's anything wrong with Linux. Because Linux is an offshoot of Ubuntu.
Right. Oh, I see what's going on. Danny's sight impaired, so he needs to have Linux so it'll talk to him while he sets it up. Yeah, I go for it.
Right.
Otherwise, if you used Ubuntu, you'd have to install Orca.
Right, unless you used one of the earlier releases of Ubuntu where it was possible to start Orca as you were installing it. And there's a key command for that. I don't recall what it is offhand, but it's one of the things that you can put in as you're booting. But my understanding is the latest release of Ubuntu has taken that out, which may be why Danny's asking us for this. So
sure.
Linux provides you with the ability to do all of that, and it also has a graphical user interface that works quite nicely for the sighted folks, and so that might work for your uncle just no trouble at all.
Sounds good to me. Next up, Jess provided a suggestion for speeding up Linux Mint by using Prelink. Jess says, "Hey, Tom and Larry." Hey, Jess.
Hey, Jess.
"I found this very nice tip in the Mint forum on how to make software open faster." And she gives us a link that we will include in the show notes. "It refers to Mint Debian. However, I followed the directions on my Ubuntu-based Mint box, and it works like a charm. Jess."
Well, thanks, Jess.
And Larry, what is it?
You install this utility called Prelink. You put a command into one of the configuration files, and what it does is it actually pre-links the application that you're running to its libraries that it needs, and so it doesn't have to go searching for those libraries when you launch something like LibreOffice or OpenOffice. It already knows which ones to link to, and so it just speeds up that process. And looking at that post, some folks have improved their LibreOffice or OpenOffice speed at launching from multiple seconds, tens of seconds, down to about 5 or 4 or 3 seconds in some cases on some older machines, I'm assuming. So it definitely does work. I tried it on one of my older machines and it helped a little bit. I guess it wasn't all that old, but it does help. It does work. So I verified that. And to be fair to Jess, I don't know whether Jess is a he or a she, but it is Jess.
Okay.
And our next email is from Iagil, who provided some suggestions we've actually heard before. And hopefully, Iagil, I've got your name pronounced correctly. I went on a website to find out how to pronounce things. We'll include in the show notes the website. And if you ever need it, Tom, for pronouncing some names of some of our non-English origin folks, that might be helpful.
It sounds good.
It was for me. Yeah, it does sound good. Anyway, Iagil says, "Hi there, Larry and Tom." Here's our chance, Tom.
Hi, Iagil.
Hi, Iagil. A little more practice, Tom.
Yeah.
Anyway, "I just this week discovered your great podcast show, and I am listening through all the episodes in the archive. I live in Stockholm, Sweden, and I am working as a network technician daytime and as a newspaper courier at night. When I'm running up and down the stairs at night, I love to listen to audiobooks and podcasts. I just recently discovered the Linux Podcast Universe and have been listening to Mintcast, Linux Outlaws, and the UK Loco Ubuntu Podcast. Your show, though, beats them all by far. I like your approach with teaching Linux to newbies as well as giving very useful advice to more experienced users. And you do it with humor, but still very professionally. It is fascinating how much community activity there is in North America compared to sparse activity I've seen in Sweden. I have found no Swedish podcasts at all with a Linux bias. My interest in Linux has grown for the past 10 years to a level where I only want to use Linux, at least privately. I have mostly been using Debian-based distributions, Ubuntu earlier, but since Unity, primarily Linux Mint. I still keep testing new distributions. Still, I would like to run Debian, which has not been hard to install and run, but I keep getting back to Mint, where Adobe, Flash, and more hardware drivers are already installed. Mepis is another nice and very stable distribution, which is based on Debian's stable version. It is very easy to install and run and has Adobe Flash and immediately recognizes my hardware in my Dell and HP laptops. Enough about that, but I have a tip about really nice small Linux distro called Pendrive Linux, or rather a set of tools for creating USB disks. And that's available at www.pendrivelinux.com. And he continues, "The tool I have tested is one called Yumi Multiboot USB Creator." And we'll have a link to that. It's also on the pendrivelinux.com site. And I know you and I have talked about both of these products in past podcasts. So
Okay, well, thanks for the feedback, Eagle, and for all the kind words.
All right.
Next up, we have Evil J, who found a virus on Linux. And Evil J says, "Hello, gentlemen."
Hello, Evil J.
In your recent Advanced Antivirus podcast, you welcomed people to message you if their virus scan turned up any viruses which were not due to dual booting Windows. Well, mine did. Three viruses, in fact. But they were still Windows viruses. They were just garbage in my Thunderbird junk folder that I had never even read. However, if I had read these messages and been so stupid, blind, drunk as to click on the attached EXEs, they probably would have run. Because I, like many of your viewers, have wine on my box. So, that would have cost me a full 60 plus seconds of removing the hidden wine directory and then rerunning and reconfiguring wine config. It's very nice that the Linux antivirus programs can be used on Linux mail servers to sanitize the messages destined to Windows boxes. I wonder how long before an AV manufacturer gets smart and lets us scan our virtual machines too, so we don't need individual antivirus software inside them. Ah, to dream. Anyway, keep up the great podcasts. Evil J. Jesse. Thanks, Jesse.
Yeah.
That was kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Just a little. Yeah. Okay, so now we have another Swedish name. Joran found a virus. Another one. Dear Mr. Bushy. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Joran.
Why so formal with me?
Yeah, and me, it's just, hey, Tom.
Okay, anyway, you asked in episode 148 if anybody had found any kind of viruses on the Linux systems. I have, but it wasn't anything strange about it. I was part of managing some Linux server machines at my daughter's school. One was, among other things, running as mail server for the school. Many users read their mail using thin Linux clients, but some use Windows machines. So we use ClamAV as a mail filter. So-called milter.
Ah.
Never heard it called a milter, but okay. To prevent incoming Windows viruses from spreading. And it did indeed find a virus in the incoming mail now and then. So I have seen Windows viruses on Linux machines. I guess the viruses aren't too picky about whom they try to infect. This is a variation of one of your use cases to protect Windows machines around you from getting infected. Not to protect the Linux machine itself. Another thing, for testing if the virus scanner works, I have been using ICAR. This is a test virus, a string meant to be caught by virus scanners but not actually working as a virus. And he provides a link to the Wikipedia page about ICAR. And I have used that as well, and it works quite nicely. So thanks, Joran.
Yeah, thank you, Joran. Good advice. And next we have a Gone Linux story from listener Bill. And Bill wanted to know about dumping an expensive proprietary firewall. Bill says, "Hi Larry, hi Tom, hi Bill."
Hi Bill.
He goes on to say, "I'm hoping this turns into a Gone Linux story. I recently became the IT department at a small company that has 10 remote locations running Windows PCs. The PCs don't run any local programs or store files locally. They just use them for web access and to connect with remote desktops to Windows servers at the central office. Each location currently has a SonicWall firewall device. The firewall hardware includes licenses for VPN, antivirus, anti-spam, etc. The licenses expire every year and a fee has to be paid to keep the service active. I want to recommend that they dump the firewalls and use the firewall included with the cable modem and run Linux on the computers. It seems to me that this would prevent the probability of virus infections, malware, spyware, and zombie machines. I've tested this out, and everything, except printing to their Sharp printers, works great. In speaking to one of the vendors we work with who is familiar with Linux, he said that there could still be security problems. He recommended we put Vyatta, V-Y-A-T-T-A, open source, firewalls at each site, using any spare machines we might, but don't, have. Of course, he's also willing to sell us small appliances that will do this as well. The big advantage to Vyatta is that there's no annual licensing fee. So the question, how important is it to have a dedicated firewall to protect a site with Linux computers? Thanks for the hard work and the great podcast you guys put out. I really appreciate it. Bellin, Ohio. And Larry, you answered.
I did. Hi, Bill. First, let me say that I am not an expert in networking, and I am not an expert in security, so please take this as my opinion based on my experience. I took a look at the specs for the three versions of SonicWall firewall devices, and looks like they perform several functions. First is a hardware firewall. Any common router will handle that part. There's no annual license fee to renew with a simple router. You just purchase the hardware, configure it, and let it run. Make sure that you get one that is capable of handling the number of computers at each location. Don't go cheap on these, since they will see heavy traffic if everything is done via the network or the internet. You can use part of the savings from the SonicWall license fees to pay for these. Use the rest of the savings to pay for some nice Linux-compatible network printers. If you need more justification for the expenditure, I have some more suggestions at the end of this email. The second function of these devices is a software firewall. If 100% of the computers at each of the remote locations runs Linux, there's no need for a software firewall at all. Every Linux distribution either comes with a software firewall or has one available in the repositories. Mint comes with UFW, Uncomplicated Firewall, which is as uncomplicated as its name suggests. This may be where the Vyatta recommendation comes in. If there is any chance that someone might bring a Windows computer into one of these remote locations and put it on the network, having a software firewall that is centrally managed can have some significant advantages. Even if you have only Linux computers, a centrally managed firewall allows you to control the settings rather than risk that a user accidentally or intentionally disables the firewall on the workstation. Third, the devices provide antivirus, anti-malware protection. Not needed in Linux. I suspect the server has antivirus software or should, so you can rely on that to ensure that Windows viruses don't get passed along in the email messages. Even if you have to add an antivirus solution to the email server, that is just one license instead of 10. Fourth, the devices provide anti-spam protection. Again, this is something that I think could be added at the email server instead of paying for it 10 times. By the way, if you're using Gmail as your email service, then you don't need anti-spam software. Google's spam reporting services seems to do an excellent job. If you need to justify the purchase of hardware to run the Vyatta firewall, remember you're not spending money on all of these areas, and those savings could pay for those devices. 1. SonicWall annual licenses and support for each of the 10 locations. 2. Windows licenses for each of the workstations in each location. 3. Operating system upgrades to keep each computer up to date with the most recent and secure version. 4. Hardware upgrades for each computer to be able to run the next version of Windows because it requires beefier hardware than the previous one. 4. Licenses for other proprietary software you may have installed on the workstations to do things like screen captures, local word processing, etc., if you use those things. 6. This point and the next apply if you are currently using Microsoft Office on the local machines rather than from the server. you won't need to pay for the upgrades to the latest version of Microsoft Office just because the file formats have changed and your customers are now sending you DocX files that Word 2003 won't open. LibreOffice and OpenOffice both open and can save to the latest Microsoft Office document formats. 7. You won't have to spend money on retraining users how to use the ribbon menu in Microsoft Office 2010 and Windows 8 when they were perfectly happy using the standard menu style that every other software application and operating systems use. I hope this helps. Let us know how it goes, and we'll share your experiences.
And I also sent Bill a short note. I said, just a short afterword to Larry's advice, check out Shields Up and let it bash itself against your defenses. I'm running stock Ubuntu 10.04, and it says that I'm bulletproof. And we will put a link to Shields Up in the show notes. It's a site that tries like heck to crack your machine. It checks all of your ports to see what's open and what's closed, and if there are any vulnerabilities, it'll let you know. And that said, at the time that I wrote to Bill, the Linux Foundation website was down due to an attack of unknown cause. So I don't know what caused that. Maybe somebody did come up with a virus.
And maybe so, or maybe it's just a
denial of service.
Denial of service or something, and I haven't heard that they've resolved it yet. It's been down for a while, too.
Yeah, so. Sure has.
Yeah. So, and for those of you who do have a spare computer and would like to set up your own firewall, Chris and Alan over at Jupiter Broadcasting started a series of episodes on the TechSnap podcast discussing how to set up a professional quality router using pfSense. And we'll include a link in the show notes to that article. pfSense runs on BSD and is truly a professional quality router and firewall and everything else that if you do have a spare box you can put it on. It would be a great way to have a professional quality protection for each of these 10 sites that Bill was talking about. But in following up with Bill, turns out there is only one person at each of these sites, so the savings in computer hardware and software licenses and so on that I was talking about in my response may not have been quite so great that he would be able to actually buy another device to put this on. But if those folks from SonicWall will allow you to keep their hardware after terminating their services, then maybe you could put pfSense on those devices.
Oh, there you go.
Actually already paid for them. But I suspect it's just a lease or something like that. You'll have to give them back. Well, Tom, that's it.
We wrapped it up.
Quite a few. We did wrap up. Yes, we did. So our next episode, Tom, is Computer America number 43. Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations.
And please email us with your comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the Podcast Alley button to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on their site.
And if you want to vote for us on iTunes, go ahead and do that. We can't get to it because iTunes doesn't work on Linux and we don't have Windows machines. So other people will look at it, though. You can also send us audio comments by email. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com and our voicemail line is 1-904-468-7889.
You can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We're Going Linux, all one word.
You can download the episodes from our website, or you can use the HTML5 or the Flash Player to play them right there on the show notes page and enjoy. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Kapla. Maybe not. Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.